You are listening to Angel Insights, brought to you by Syndicate Room. This is the show that delves inside the world of angel investing to reveal the tips, tactics, and strategies of the world's best angels. And joining me today, we really do have a legend of industry. I'm so delighted to welcome Chris Mayers to the show today. Now, where do I start with Chris? Well, he's the chief scientist at Metaswitch, where he's seen the company's exponential growth over the last few decades, including the raising of their first VC money in 2008 with the likes of Sequoia and Francisco Partners Investing. He's also a prolific angel investor, and I've seen many an angel portfolio, but I do not think I've seen any as exciting as I do with Chris's, with the likes of Magic Pony, SmartUp, and AdBrain all being investments of Chris's. And if that wasn't enough, he's also the chair of Code Club and the UK Forum for Computer Education. Finally, to cap it all off, he's also a fellow of the British Computer Society and a fellow of the Royal Academy of Engineering, a true legend of industry, and I'm so honoured to welcome Chris Mayers to the show today. Chris, welcome to Angel Insights. It's absolutely fantastic to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Now, I'd love to start off with a little bit of a tough question, and it's a background question, just for a bit of context. So could you give us a brief synopsis of your career with Metaswitch and how you came to be where you are today and came to be an angel investor?
Sure. So I was one of the co-founders of Metaswitch way back in 1981. And my background is technical. So I did a degree in computer science at Cambridge when there was only enough material to make it into a one-year course, which dates me slightly.
What was that, 5 years ago?
I wish. Then I was chief technical officer at Metaswitch for a long period of time. We bootstrapped that business, always profitable from day one. And then in about 2007, we took a substantial chunk of secondary investment from Sequoia Capital and Francisco Partners because we felt that having a tier one VC involved in the business would actually open doors with some of the very large enterprise customers that we were dealing with at that time. And it also released some significant liquidity for many of the employees because the business at that stage was owned by an employee benefit trust. Sequoia and Francisco have been great as investors. They have allowed the culture of the organization to stay the same, which was very important to us. We are a UK-based business, and most of our engineers are based in the UK, but most of our customers have always been based in North America, which was one of the reasons why we were attractive to West Coast VCs. As part of that investment, one of the things that Sequoia did say was, you know, you really ought to take some of your smart engineers, because you've got great engineers, you've got great products, but Enfield, North London, not really where it's happening, is it? So maybe you ought to take a small bunch of smart engineers, stick them in the valley, get them to mix with a portfolio. Something interesting will come of that. So this was in 2010, and I was lucky enough to be the guy who went out as the responsible adult looking after a bunch of young engineers in Silicon Valley for a couple of years, doing an internally funded startup, which was great fun. Also got to spend a fair bit of time talking with the partners at Sequoia, understanding a little bit more about the investment space, so that when I came back to the UK, the UK angel investing ecosystem had pretty much completely transformed itself between the beginning of 2010 and the end of 2011. And it was becoming a very vibrant space around Old Street. Various things had happened that meant it was now a very exciting place to do angel investing. So that's what I started doing. I now have a portfolio of about 50 companies.
What a brilliant synopsis. My word, if every guest could be as concise as that, it'd be a very easy job.
You are too kind.
So there's a lot to unpack there, but actually that ended very nicely for this transition in terms of, you said about understanding from speaking to Sequoia. What were the kind of lessons that you took from them and how they process their investments that you've applied to your angel investing now back in the UK?
Well, I remember one thing that Jim Getz, who's the Sequoia partner who sits on our board, said to me when we were talking about why Sequoia had invested in Metaswitch. And he said, our normal investment thesis is pretty simple. There are three things that need to happen. The first is that we like to get in when there is still, you know, the company is still at a relatively early stage, ready for some spectacular growth. He said the second thing is that we need to be able to cycle from our offices to the headquarters of the business that we're investing in. The third thing is the people. And he said, well, Metaswitch is 25 years old. So, you know, the chance for spectacular growth is probably not the same as many of our portfolio companies. He said, the second thing is we clearly cannot cycle from Palo Alto to Enfield. He said, so all I conclude is that you must have scored triple score on the people. Because, like, you know, he said, at the end of the day, seriously, the thing is the people. That's what Sequoia really invests in. That sort of resonated with the way that I think about recruitment and management at Metaswitch. And it made me realize that actually, because I thought I was being rather simplistic, you know, you've got to look at the target market. You've got to look at whether the product is plausible in the market. But at the end of the day, investing at such an early stage as I do, it's almost inevitable that teams are going to pivot at some way before they actually get to product market fit. Mm-hmm. So what you really, really care about is are the people talented enough and strong enough and ambitious enough?
So do you think that, because in terms of getting Sequoia to invest outside their traditional mandate of kind of relatively early stage, how was that then as a founding team in terms of portraying the narrative and the actual fundraising process with them?
That was a slightly tongue-in-cheek explanation because Sequoia do have a growth fund and they did invest in us in their growth fund. But even so, I think we were quite atypical even for the growth fund. It would be untrue to pretend that we set out with a conscious decision that said, right, we're going to get Sequoia to invest. The reality was we spoke to various VCs it was almost because we didn't need to raise the money. It was much more about finding a VC where we felt it was a good cultural fit. And perhaps, I don't know, I'm second guessing what Sequoia's reasoning was, but part of it was maybe that we didn't have this understanding that Sequoia were these gods of VC investment, because we knew nothing about the VC investment space, to be honest. We'd built this business for 25 years. And so we looked at various VCs and thought these Sequoia guys looked pretty reasonable.
They seem nice.
Yeah, they seem like good guys. So we took their money. And it was only afterwards that I realized quite what an amazing organization Sequoia was. So maybe it was that we weren't so much in awe of them that actually allowed us to connect with them.
And you said there about Metaswitch, obviously an operating and profitable business for 25 years. My word, a staggering feat in any environment, but particularly profitable in today's environment. My word. So with Metaswitch, then, you've seen the full life cycle of the business and seen it grow exponentially. So I'm intrigued to hear which element of the journey was your favourite to work in. Was it the very early days? Was it kind of seeing the hyper-growth mode? What was it for you?
I think the early stage is... It was the most exciting stage. You're living absolutely on the edge. You're selling product that is clearly not yet field hardened, and you're going to have to work really hard to make sure that you deliver the quality that your customers are expecting. So it's really, really intense. There's lots of knife edge moments. You're never quite sure that the business is going to be stable. But the sense of achievement when you look back, and you do have to keep looking back to remind yourself how much you've done in the previous 12 months, the previous 2 years, the sense of achievement is significant. And the growth is very exciting in terms of bringing new people into the organization and seeing how you've grown up from being a startup that's got some smart people in it into something that is actually got some substance. I guess another period which was quite interesting was when we first started building a significant community of telecoms service providers. We'd moved from selling to computer manufacturers to selling directly to service providers. When we'd got to about 15 or so service providers, we did our first user forum for them. Now, I remember when it was probably about our third user forum, we had something like 600 people in the audience, and we had a serious AV system in a quite a plush hotel on the West Coast. And I remember saying to the chief executive at the time, God, this feels like a real company, doesn't it? This is weird. And that was like 20 years into the business, but it was only then that you suddenly think, wow, this feels like a real company.
So you said there also about the people, and in terms of kind of talking about those early days and then scaling up, how was the scaling process for you in terms of recruitment of incredibly smart people to kind of fit the Metaswitch culture?
We took a slightly unusual approach, which was that we grew the business exclusively by recruiting graduates straight out of university. It was very much an engineering-led business for the early years. We decided that we'd get a higher success rate by taking really smart people, bringing them into the Metaswitch culture and training them. And quite often we took people who didn't even have any computing background. So we were also training them on the technology as well as on the culture and how to interact in a team. And we found that to be easier and more satisfying than we had two or three attempts to take engineers in from industry and didn't have a great success rate. So that growth was oriented around doing quite a heavy milk round process at the top universities and getting ourselves known at the top universities as being a smart place for good ambitious people to join.
And do you apply that same approach to your investing in terms of kind of requiring heavy academics and young founders? Is that very much the thinking? I know you're an investor in Smartup, and although Frank is a fantastic chap, he's not quite just out of university. I was wondering if that university graduate characteristic is applied to your angel investing.
That's interesting because since we, in the last 10 or 15 years at Metaswitch, we've actually changed quite a lot. And we do a lot of recruitment from industry now, particularly on the customer-facing side of the business. So I've now got, I think, a more balanced view of the relative benefits of smart young people and people who've got some scars on their back from actually being in out there in industry. And I think both parts of an organization are important. So if I'm looking at an investment opportunity, then still the talent of the individuals running it is more important to me than their academics. You know, the fact that someone's got a first class honors degree from Cambridge is a reasonable proxy for being smart. That was, I think, one of the reasons why we were looking at, in those days, for very strong academics. Although, interestingly, a lot of the startups that I'm investing in at the moment are doing a lot of work with AI and machine learning. And for those guys, PhDs, are actually very relevant. And so I would say probably now I'm actually looking more for a combination of talent, sector expertise, and real hardcore academic background.
Well, it's brilliant that you discussed AI there, because that was very much concretely on the schedule with your role at AdBrain, which for anyone who hasn't checked out, phenomenally exciting company in the AI space. So I'd love to hear what you think of the wider AI community now, its rise to prominence in recent, it seems, months, where suddenly this mass hype has realised the potential for AI. So what are your thoughts on this and the kind of mass hype surrounding it?
I think you're right that there is hype. But there is also underlying that, there's a lot of reality in just in terms of how much progress there's been on machine learning over the last 4-5 years. So at the moment, it feels to me almost that if you're not doing machine learning, you probably shouldn't be doing a startup. And if you feel the need to mention the fact that you're doing machine learning, you probably shouldn't be doing a startup either. So it's almost become a de facto part of being a startup in the specific spaces I'm looking at the moment. So there is hype, but there is also phenomenal progress that's happened academically and also in some of the stuff that's been put into open source and some of the stuff that the big players like Microsoft and Google are doing in terms of making APIs available. So the question, I think, is going to be in 2-3 years' time, will there still be a need for founders to have some real academic background in machine learning, or will it be something that anyone who could do a web startup 10 years ago can equally now do a machine learning AI-based startup?
Does the rise of open source not slightly allow accessibility to increase to those that don't have kind of PhDs from Cambridge in machine learning?
For sure, yes, very definitely. I mean, you can do a lot with machine learning these days without having done any academic background in it at all. On the other hand, if you're trying to build a really unique technology-based company, then having some edge on understanding how to push the machine learning beyond what's currently available out there in the open source is important.
One thing that always strikes me with AI, though, recently is my concern that there's an incumbency advantage for the big players who have the largest data sets, because AI, to a large extent, is mostly about availability of data. So do you think that these big players do have an incumbency advantage that will create significant barriers to entry for the startups coming in?
I think you're exactly right that access to the data is probably the most important thing for an AI-based startup. If you're an incumbent, then clearly, if you're an incumbent with a very large consumer base or just a very, very large customer base, then you intrinsically have access to data that is helpful. But a lot of the startups that I'm working with are finding incredibly creative ways to acquire data without having any incumbency, either through partnerships or through contacts, and sometimes getting data in countries where there is less of a barrier in terms of regulations and data protection. So I'm not saying the data is in any way unethical, but I'm saying that sometimes in the UK, if you're looking for sensitive data, it's incredibly hard to go through all the hoops of regulation to actually get access to it.
And my word, this is a hard question here, but you said obviously about sectors that you're interested in within machine learning. What use cases are you most excited for and see the most potential in?
I think that the important thing is to find a sector that is ready for disruption and then find a way to disrupt it using machine learning. So one example would be a company that I'm working with who are looking at the car insurance space, a company called Tractable.
Alex Daliak.
Yeah.
He's amazing.
He is amazing. That's another classic example of investing in people. Alex is superbly driven, also incredibly smart, as is his co-founder, Razvan. And so what they're doing is they're taking machine learning and going into a pretty slow-moving sector and saying, can we use this to help automate insurance claim assessment? This is not glamorous, but it's there is an awful lot of money in car insurance. And I think what they will do, they will build a business there across many different sectors. But you know, they need to find a sector in which they can insert themselves. And this is the one they've chosen to start with. And other areas that I'm seeing a lot of application of AI at the moment are, there's another company that I'm invested in called Magic Pony Technology.
Rob Bishop.
Rob Bishop. I'm actually the chairman at Magic Pony.
Are you?
Yeah.
So I was in Balderton when they were incubated there.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. I'm surprised we didn't bump into each other. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because we still have our board meetings at Balderton.
Do you?
Yeah.
Rob's exceptional, though.
Yes, he's exceptional. He's just out in San Francisco at the moment. They've been speaking at a big conference on using machine learning in image processing. So what they're doing is they are applying machine learning to video, either to augment the video, to do synthetic texture generation, to do compression, a whole variety of different applications of machine learning to actually mean that we can, you know, because video distribution across the mobile internet is very challenging for a whole variety of people in terms of the amount of bandwidth usage and the sort of tension between the amount of bandwidth that's available and the sort of quality of video image that people are demanding. And they're using video process machine learning to process the video on the client side and actually produce some amazing results.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I saw them speak at London AI and they did a demo and that was incredible.
Yeah.
But now, final question before we dive into a quick fire round, and that is, you've worked now with Entrepreneur First and it kind of ties back into the people first oriented angel investing thesis. And so I have to ask, in a video I saw you said that, you know, you've had big learnings from the EF experience. And I wanted to know, what were those big learnings and how have you applied them to your own personal investing?
So just for anybody who doesn't know, Entrepreneur First takes smart people who don't necessarily even have an idea, let alone a product or a co-founder, and then do a fantastically rapid ideation process over a period of several weeks in which teams are formed, teams break up. Out of that come businesses with ideas that within a period of 6 months, we get them through to a point where they are investable. And the progress that they make is absolutely astonishing. The reason they do that is partly to do with the EF process, but it's partly to do with the big vision, ambition, and sometimes naivety, to be perfectly honest, of the people coming into the program. You know, if you don't know what all the problems are, then you, perhaps you're less scared about them. And so you will make plays that nobody in their right mind who's actually been in a sector for like 20 years would ever dream of doing, because they just know all the barriers and problems. So it's that balance between self-belief, but also tied back into reality by, you know, I guess my role there is to pressure test the ideas and help the teams to demonstrate product market fit and say, okay, sounds like a great idea, but what's the reality? You know, have you taken this to any prospective customers yet and found out whether there's a real pain point and how much they're prepared to pay for it?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I'd love to dive into a quick fire round now with you. So I say a short statement and you give me your immediate thoughts. Sound good?
Okay. Sounds good.
So your favourite book and why?
Birdsong, Sebastian Falls, because it is just unbelievably moving in the way it's written.
Now, looking back at the incredible career and many more to come, but career highlight for you so far?
Leaving IBM and joining Metaswitch.
But no, it's a good answer. And then who's been the biggest mentor for you throughout your career?
My boss at work, a guy called John Lazar. Mm-hmm.
And then what did you used to fervently believe that you now no longer do?
I used to believe in my early 20s that the difficult part of the business was the technology. Actually, I'm increasingly starting to realize that's just one of the difficult parts.
There's many more. The most transformational shift in tech in your career, was it the kind of, you know, rise of mobile? Was it whatever?
No, it was actually earlier than that. It was the rise of the internet. I mean, we, for the first 20 years at Metaswitch, we did the internet. Certainly for the first 10-12 years, the internet did not exist.
And then the biggest value add you believe an angel can have?
Insight derived from experience.
And then finally, the most recent investment for you and why you said yes?
Cloud NC, which is a business that is going to disrupt the computer-controlled milling machine sector, which is like machines that make physical parts of steel or titanium or whatever. It's an industry that has not changed for the last 30 years, and it's about to.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for joining me on the show today. It really has been an absolute pleasure, and I'm so grateful for you sharing your story.
Thanks very much, Harry. I've enjoyed it.
What an amazing episode that was with Chris, and so fantastic to hear his incredible journey with Metaswitch. And if you'd like to see the article that accompanies the show for today, then head over to syndicateroom.com, where you can see the Learning Academy. Likewise, if you're loving the show, do tweet us at syndicateroom. Before we leave, we'd like to remind you that early stage investing is risky. Therefore, please ensure that you engage in the proper due diligence prior to making the investment. Thank you so much, as always, for your continued support, and we look so forward to bringing you next week's episode.